experiences of synchronicity and the paranormal in analysis. And what I was going to deliver to you is chapter 10 of my recent book, which never got published. So I've arranged with Lorraine to, I will send a PDF and you will get it on your email and you can read it. So you'll have chapter 10 of the book that never appeared in the book because Routledge would not allow it. It made the book too long. So, what? Yeah, I think there probably is another reason too, but in any case, you will have the chance to read it. I think it's an important sort of ending space because, the whole book is framed between two worlds, right? The spiritual, the material, eternal time, all that. And this final chapter brings the two worlds together in a kind of underlying third, which Jung called the psychoid, or the realm of synchronicity. So that there was a kind of undergirding third reality beyond the opposites that seems to explain some of these synchronous experiences that are completely mysterious otherwise. It's like a field that's bigger than the field we live in the sense of opposites. And so Jung has some, well, I'll read this final chapter, the final paragraph in this chapter, just because it's a quote from Jung, and I think it, his first experience of synchronicity was that he was sitting with a woman patient who was completely obsessional and very much in her left hemisphere and unable to relate in a feeling way, and he was longing for something irrational to come in, something in a feeling way. And she had had a dream the night before of a golden scarab beetle. And as she was, telling this dream, Jung heard a tick, tick, tick on the behind him. And he turned around and there was a beetle trying to get in. And he opened the window and the beetle flew in and he caught it. And he handed it to the woman and said, "Here's your scarab." And he was sort of blown away, she was blown away by the fortuitous synchronicity, that is to say, nothing could have caused that, but it was a meaningful coincidence. It was something that happened that seemed to defy time and space parameters, but it was meaningful, linked through meaning. So Jung got very, here's what he says. Under the impact of such experiences, reason evaporates and another power spontaneously takes control. A most singular feeling, which one willy-nilly hoards up as a secret treasure, no matter how much one's reason may protest. That indeed is the uncomprehended purpose of the experience, to make us feel the overpowering presence of a mystery. Synchronous events break through the monotony of daily life with salutary effects, sometimes, shaking up our certitudes and lending wings to the imagination. Isn't that great? So that, you'll read some wonderful accounts about how psychoanalysts have been sort of shocked and blown away by experiences that they can't describe or can't explain in any linear cause and effect fashion. And so it does open us all up to two worlds that we live suspended in between. So that's the sublime. Now we're going to the ridiculous. that's a quote from his essay on synchronicity. And you'll get the references.
You're going to leave this topic now, the paranormal?
Yeah.
Okay, can I ask one question?
Sure.
Okay. Only because I came loaded for bear on this question. I was so excited, and I'm not sorry that you're going to the other topic because I think it's so critical as we return to the world. But, I started exploring all those places where I felt I'd encountered people built like you're describing, whether it's Joan of Arc or Cassandra or and all of these. And you see how this is consigned to almost always the feminine.
It's consigned to the feminine?
Or seems to be allowed, or erupts through or from.
Hmm.
And maybe I'm wrong, but when you say that Rutledge did not want to publish that chapter, it seems to me as if legitimizing these phenomena might lift it beyond just female experience. You know, if you start thinking about the science of the field and so on, and I'm just struck.
Well, I want very much to publish this, but I'm going to have to wait to do a new edition of the book. Maybe with another publisher, or maybe by now.
Right.
I made them enough money so that maybe they... So I think that, you know, getting it out there, getting it legitimized is a very important thing. I mean, one of the things that you'll read in this chapter is that as psychoanalysts have wanted to publish this material, they have been encouraged to wait until the person died or until they died, you know, or something.
Much safer because
you know, this kind of thing, if you really publish it and identify with it in some way, it raises questions about your stability. I can't resist telling you the story about the harp. Did I tell you the story?
No.
Okay. One of the analysts who was terribly impressed by this kind of thing, for reasons you will be obvious to you, was a woman named Elizabeth Lloyd Mayer. She was a Kleinian, a very scientifically oriented kind of Freudian-trained analyst in San Francisco. And she had the following experience. Her daughter, who was now 11, had fallen in love with a medieval harp that they had purchased when she was 6, and she had learned to play it, and now she was playing it in concerts, and they had a big concert, and the concert was a 2-day affair, and so they played beautifully on Saturday, and Meg, the little girl, left her harp in the concert hall overnight, and it was stolen. And the next day they did everything. They went to the police departments, they went to pawn shops, they went online, they did everything they possibly could. They looked for weeks. They offered a reward of $3,000, which was about what the harp was worth at that point, and nothing happened. And weeks went by. Finally, Libby Mayer, which is what she was affectionately called, was talking with a Jungian friend. And she said, "I just don't know what to do." And the Jungian friend said, "Have you consulted a dowser?" And she said, "What?" A dowser was somebody that found water, you know, in fields and things. And this woman said, Jungian friend, "Well, they are called in on police reports. They find missing things, missing bodies, missing jewels and stuff." So. This woman said, "I happen to know who the head of the American Dowsing Society is, and he happens to live in Alabama, and here's his number, call him up." So this very one-dimensional psychoanalyst sort of thought to herself, "Oh God, what am I doing?" So she called this person up, and in this heavy southern accent, this guy says, "Yes, ma'am, I can find it for you if you just give me some time." And he said, "Just a minute." And there was a long silence. And she was calling from San Francisco. And he said, "I think it's in Oakland. Does that make any sense to you?" She said, "Yeah, that's a community right nearby me." And he says, "Well, I'm pretty sure it's there. Send me a map of the city of Oakland, a detailed map, street map, everything. I want to know as much detail as you've got." So she sent off this map. This was, I think, before, you know, you could have Googled the map. And a week later, she got a call, and the guy said, "Yep, it's in a greenhouse on the corner of such and such a street and such a street." And she said, "You're kidding." And so she got in her car, and she drove to the corner, and there was the house that he had described. And she went to the police station. She said, there's a harp in that house and I need to get a warrant for entry to recover my harp. And the police officer looked at her like she was absolutely crazy. And he said, lady, I understand that you think this is happening, but we need more than that evidence to get a search warrant for this house. So she didn't know what to do. So she got great big pieces of paper and she put reward notices on each phone call on each corner of that intersection. A day later, she got a call. Meet me in the parking lot of the Safeway store at midnight, and I'll give you your heart. $3,000. So she thought, my God, is this going to be a murder or what? Crazy. And so she got the police to stake out the parking lot, and she drove, and she met a teenager, and he got out, and in his trunk was the harp, and gave it to her, and she exchanged $3,000, and she drove home. And as she drove into her driveway, she heard the voice say, "This changes everything." And she then set about to write a book, which I recommend, called Anomalous Phenomena, Extraordinary Knowing. It's called Extraordinary Knowing. And it's about her. She then combined her efforts with Carol Gilligan at Harvard, and they together offered a seminar at the APA meetings, American Psychological Association meetings, on therapists, for therapists who had experienced these kinds of anomalous experiences. And they didn't expect it, but 250 people signed up for a seminar. And these therapists reported amazing experiences, which you can only imagine would happen, because when you're sitting with somebody, you know, therapy is a field that's constellated where the ego threshold is lowered, and you're attending to the unconscious, and you're in a maybe a highly emotional field, because one of the things they find is that synchronicities occur when the emotional field is constellated. The Ryan experiments, J.B. Ryan, for example, discovered that people who had uncanny abilities to spot cards in these otherwise double-blind studies always did much better if there was a high emotional charge. Pardon?
Students at a college telling us yes, right, most for phone or video, so not even in the same room, and they did EEG, and within 7.5 minutes of the narratives, people, within 7.5 minutes, the brainwave patterns synchronized even when they weren't in the same room.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's remarkable stuff, and it's all verified. The problem with it is that it's anecdotal. You can't publish this stuff as statistical formulations or.
This one's in publication, right?
Is it? Okay, good. Good.
Can you repeat her name, please? The author's name?
Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R. Elizabeth Lloyd Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R. Extraordinary Knowing. Okay, now, we're going to switch gears now, and what I'm going to ask you for is for your collaboration in this. This is hot off the press. I've just written it. It will be published sometime later this year in a book on American cultural complexes, to be published by an analyst in San Francisco named Tom Singer. But it won't be out for at least 6 months, and so you're going to be among the first to hear it.
Is he June Singer's son?
No, he's not. Good question, though. So what I'm trying to do in this essay is apply the self-care system as you've seen it in the two angels, light and dark angel, and the dual child, the innocent child and the empirical child together, to the situation we find ourselves in the country. And the analysis goes like this. This system, what I call a self-care system, is a dissociation system. It's a system of dissociation. Right? It's in all of us, in a more muted form or a slightly diffused form, but in people with a severe trauma history, it comes into focus or into manifestation in a more vivid way, and you start to see these images in dreams where you wouldn't necessarily expect them. So that's what happened in my own experience when I discovered the self-care system. It was because I had this culture of highly traumatized individuals who I didn't know, but they had an early trauma history. And so their unconscious material was filled up with these extreme figures, these archetypal figures, light and dark angels, innocent children, persecution,
victimization,
the whole nine yards. So I think this system exists in all of us. If you want to think about it, these angels represent nothing more nor less than archetypal affects, primary archetypal affects, the negative affects and the positive affects. In their angelic form, they're daimonic creatures, so that they are 880 volts of affect. If you've ever had a child, you know what a two-year-old temper tantrum is like. A two-year-old who is enraged that he can't have his ice cream cone at the time that he wants it is channeling the dark angel.
Grand mal seizure.
What's that?
It's like a grand mal seizure.
It's like a grand mal seizure. If you've ever been there, you know that it's impossible. And impossible for the child, impossible for you. And slowly, over time, that 880 volts gets transformed from 880 to 440 to 220 to 110.
And then
you get to use your anger. It gets connected to words. And you can start to say things like, you hurt my feelings and I'm pissed off at you. Now that takes, 76 years. I'm only
lucky for you.
Okay, the same is true in the
love channel.
There's 880 volts of love. It's called possession. If you love, your grandma like I love my grandma to the point where I would bite her every time I saw her, you don't take kindly to the limitations when she tells you that she's about to leave. Okay, so that, just as we have primordial affects of love and hate, we have to humanize these things, and that's what happens. If 880 volts arrives at your house, it goes through a thing called a transformer. Sits on the light pole outside your house. That's where the transformation occurs. But in human experience, it happens only in the rough and tumble of relationship. And slowly, 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 we transform raw archetypal affects into feelings. And then we have something we can work with relationally.
Now, of course,
we also have moments when we get triggered and we blow up. Hopefully those moments are then, can be held in a relational field and worked through so that, you get to say, I'm sorry, and the other person can apologize too for massacring you, and you come out of it with a relationship. It actually goes deeper. You all have that experience. So, for 50 years now, I've been practicing trying to understand these archetypal emotions, affects, and how to humanize them. And here's what Jung said. I start my essay with this phrase, quote, "The world hangs on a thin thread, and that thread is the psyche of man. We are the great danger now." The psyche is the great danger.